with both theoretical and experimental evidence that would suggest that this actually happened, though it's not proven, and there are alternatives. So we know that inflation is going to basically solve some outstanding theoretical problems, which is standard Big Bang, solves flatness problems, solves why there's no monopoles. And it produces a homogeneous universe with Gaussian, roughly scalar invariant perturbations that agree very well with this nice WMAP data that we have and other things. But there are serious problems lurking in the background. So there are outstanding questions about the initial conditions for inflation that have been unresolved since its inception. And there's problems with interpretation. What is the inflaton? How are we supposed to interpret this? So today I'm going to talk about a specific type of inflation that goes back to the original concept, old inflation. Okay? So I'm going to consider some scalar field coupled to gravity, and it has a metastable minimum. So the higher energy vacuum I'm going to call the false vacuum, the low energy vacuum I'm going to call the true vacuum. And throughout this talk, I'm going to assume basically that both have a positive energy density. Okay, so only positive cosmological constant in the background. And we know that there's good experimental evidence that we're evolving towards to consider. We live in a universe that we think has a cosmological constant. And in the context of string theory, consider space as metastable. So this gives us some motivation for wanting to consider these type of potentials, right? Because if we're in a metastable state, that either means we're going to decay to somewhere. Well, it means we're going to decay to somewhere, probably yes. And potentially we have some potential that looks like this. So what I'd like to talk about today is perhaps what states we might be connected to and how we're connected to them. So originally, Coleman and collaborators studied scalar field theories like this, and they showed that if you have a field which is everywhere stuck in the false vacuum, then there's some finite probability that you tunnel through this barrier, end up in the true vacuum, and then in real space, this corresponds to the nucleation of a bubble filled with the true vacuum phase that expands out, eats up the false vacuum. And if this nucleation rate is small compared to this background de Sitter expansion due to the false vacuum energy density, then you get eternal inflation. And by that, I just mean that there's always somewhere in the universe that is in the false vacuum phase. Okay. Now, of course, in order to have a phenomenologically acceptable theory, if this is going to describe our universe, then I need some period of slow roll that happens at this time. Perhaps I have another field that's responsible for receiving the density perturbations. And I'd just like to point out that there's also slow roll eternal inflation, which has to do with stochastic dynamics of the field on the plot potential. But I'm not going to be talking about that today. But this is a Pandora's box, right? Because if I have eternal inflation, and if you believe in the string theory landscape, then this is going to tell you basically that low energy physics is no longer unique. I can't start from some high energy theory, string theory, and predict exactly what the values of, say, constants of nature, cosmology, etc., are in our specific region of the universe.
Why is inflation important for that?
Why is eternal inflation important? Just logically, why not just the string theory landscape implies low energy physics is not unique?
So if
when
I'm
there
stuck,
not is eternal inflation.
So if I'm stuck in one of the minima of the string theory landscape,
you're still not
I can't
unique.
Go anywhere.
You're still not unique.
But then I might hope to find the minimum that gives. So I have the landscape, right? And then this tells me predictions based on the given minima that I'm in.
What are you minimizing?
What's that?
What are you minimizing?
What am I minimizing?
Yeah. There's no conserved energy in general relativity.
Okay, so I have some potential, right? That's derived from some superpotential, some working supergravity.
Okay.
And I find the minima of that potential, and that tells me the vacuum expectation values for the moduli fields. And that tells me what the constants are going to be in my low energy effective theory.
But if you're sitting in the minimum, you would never have inflation.
So that's why we need eternal inflation, because if I have something that I'm minimizing, it tells me specifically, based on the values of the various moduli field, what my prediction is for low energy physics everywhere. If I'm not allowed to jump between the minima and say that I have non-unique low energy physics, that's all I'm trying to say. Okay? So we see that different spatiotemporal regions have different low-energy physics parameters. And by that is what I mean that this is a Pandora's box. So a question we can ask is, given this situation, if this is real, can we ever hope to make predictions about low-energy physics from high-energy physics, or is this whole game over? Now, if so, then predictions are necessarily going to be statistical. They can't make definite statements anymore. And if not, if these questions don't make sense, Then there are side benefits, right? This gives us the context to explore things like naturalness within. So if we have a whole bunch of theories lying around, then I can chop them up, see what I get, and say, okay, you know, how fine-tuned is it to get certain coupling constants and certain value? Or perhaps this can tell us about the initial conditions for inflation. So if I have a bunch of theories of inflation, a bunch of atomic potentials that are generated in this landscape, then it can tell me, well, how natural it is, do I start with the, you know, inflation scale or gut scale or something? And it might make anthropic questions more fun. So what do we do? Well, this talk is going to be split into two parts. So the first part is going to be about understanding the dynamics. So how actually would I expect to jump between these different minima in a scalar field theory coupled to gravity? This is going to be my simplified model of the landscape, which is not real. Okay? And I'm going to try and convince you that we can possibly map out what the multiverse would look like and tell you where that might evolve. And then the second part of this talk is going to be about making predictions. So we'll see if I get there. But I'd like to describe what the necessary ingredients are and perhaps what kind of observations we can hope to possibly make predictions for. So, dynamics. I have the scalar field, coupled to gravity, and I told you before that we could tunnel down. This was for originally to do Coleman and Deluccia. But we can also tunnel back up. Okay, and this is a proposal by Lee and Weinberg. So these would correspond to the formation of a bubble filled with the false vacuum phase in a background of truth. But these are not the only ways to transition. And there's been this very confusing situation in the literature where there are just sort of maybe five or six different mechanisms that are seemingly completely unrelated, that all have to do with the scalar field theory coupled with gravity, that tell you how you might transition between these various states. And what I'd like to do today is tell you about how at least four of them can be unified by considering only thin wall bubbles and writing things in terms of effective potentials according to Israel junction conditions. And there are going to be important implications for eternal inflation. I'm going to describe the map of the multiverse and understand various transitions that can be from point A to point B. So I need three ingredients to do this. I'm going to consider basically a true or false vacuum exterior, true or false vacuum interior, and a wall that has some tension. So the Coleman and Deluccia and the Weinberg bubbles that perhaps you're familiar with have zero maps. Now, this is well-defined in terms of basically, because if I had a non-zero mass, I might have, according to Kirchhoff's theorem, a Schwarzschild-Sitter space with some mass parameter n. Okay. So we're going to consider today going away from this mass equal zero limit and discussing the other transitions. To remind you what the causal structure of Schwarzschild-Sitter is, this will be important to make my points, here is a conformal diagram. So according, well, if you don't know, conformal diagrams basically are a map of the infinite space-time, the global manifold, onto a sheet of paper. So I stretch the coordinates in various ways to make this happen. But in a way, that preserves null lines. So light travels on 45 degree lines on this diagram. Here I have, this is a time-symmetric version of the space-time. So I have both the singularity in the past and the singularity in the future. Here, these surfaces are past null infinity. On the top, that's future null infinity. And I have two types of horizons. So there are black hole event horizons, which are defined by these null surfaces. And there are cosmological horizons, which are corresponding to these null surfaces. An important point to note about Schwarzschild-Sitter space is that it's a non-compact manifold. So this diagram actually repeats forever both to the left and the right. So these regions you just imagine sticking on another future null infinity, another singularity, another future null infinity, et cetera, et cetera. Now it turns out we can do something very nice. So if I consider a metric inside that Sitter and a metric outside that Schwarzschild Sitter, and I look at the allowed junctions according to Israel junction conditions, I'll show you the formulas in the next slide, then it's possible to write the wall dynamics in terms of this one-dimensional effective potential. Okay. So basically, I've got some mass parameter and some radius. And now I can talk about the trajectories as if I was talking about some particle bouncing around in a one-dimensional potential. So if I fix the mass of the solution, I can have bounce solutions, say that start from zero radius, can extend to a turning point, but then are doomed to collapse back to zero radius. Unbound solutions, that say could come in from infinity, bounce off the potential, and then go back out, and monotonic ones that could either grow forever from zero radius or shrink in from infinite radius and collapse into a singularity. So it's possible to catalog these solutions. And there are probably about 30 qualitatively different solutions, most of which I'm not going to show you today. So just to be entirely specific, in the context of Israel junction conditions, basically, I need to consider two metrics. I have the induced metric on the world sheet of the bubble wall. I have the full four-dimensional metric, which I can write in Gaussian normal coordinates, copy above form. And then I'm going to have some energy momentum tensor that describes the wall. Okay, so this is basically, the wall is described by some pure tension term, spherically symmetric, and it's a delta function in the Gaussian normal coordinate, the thing that's normal to the wall. So this is a thin wall, basically a step function between cosmological constant 1 and cosmological constant 2. So then Einstein's equations tell me that basically I get some discontinuity in the extrinsic curvature tensor, and that's going to give me the dynamics of the wall. So I can write it in terms of this one-dimensional form. Now, I'm going to draw for you the complete causal structure of these spacetimes. So I have some De Sitter interior, which is described by this De Sitter space conformal diagram on the left.
Yes. Is B complicated to write? Are you opposed to that?
No, I'm not, because it's actually much easier to work in some crazy dimensionless variables. And rather than go through the hoops that requires, I'm just going to leave that. But I can show you later if you like. So I have some De Sitter space interior and some Schwarzschild De Sitter space exterior. And to guide your eyes, basically, I have the bubble wall drawn as the line with an arrow, and I put these two diagrams together by matching the points on the bubble wall. The only thing I want you to pay attention to are the shaded regions. The white regions here are basically just to guide your eyes. So I match the shaded regions across the bubble wall, and for the next few slides, I'd like to concentrate on false vacuum bubbles. So that means you imagine that the exterior is a lower energy than the interior. So I have bound spacetimes, which I showed you before in the last slide. So these, you can see, start from zero radius, expand out to some turning point, and then collapse back in. And on the inside, the same thing occurs. Starts from zero radius, it's a turning point, goes back in.
Can I ask a naive question?
Yeah, of course.
What do you do about matching down at the singularity and up at the singularity?
So I've assumed the I've assumed the space-time in advance, right? I say that I have Schwarzschild De Sitter outside and De Sitter inside. Okay. And then I've explicitly done the matching by construction. So the matching is well defined at R equals zero by construction.
So there's a singularity outside the bubble wall and not inside the bubble wall.
That's right. Well, it's here, I guess. That point would be singular. So I have bound solutions, but I also have unbound solutions. So here I've drawn one of these for you. So just to guide your eyes, this region one is the same in both pictures. And an unbound solution looks like this. If I start from past null infinity, the wall collapses in to some turning point and then goes back out to picture null infinity. Okay. And on the inside, you can see a similar thing happening. I start from past null infinity, turning point, and back to future. And you'll note that this bubble is kind of behind a wormhole with respect to this original region one that I've shown you on the top. So it was shown that these bound solutions are classically buildable, in the sense that if I, say, choose to build a bubble with some radius bigger than the Schwarzschild radius, it's possible for me to sit down, put together some aggregation of scalar field, and construct this solution. But the unbound solutions, on the other hand, are much weirder. And you can show that the singularity theorems basically require you to violate some energy conditions in order to make this, if you want to get rid of the singularity in the past. So these solutions are classically not buildable. And because I've just sort of considered all of the possible massive bubbles, and you'll note that the inside of this bubble is sort of larger than horizon size. So I have an inflationary universe, essentially, inside of this bubble that I'm talking about. It was thought that it's very hard to actually make inflation happen. But there is a mechanism that I can consider, which of course also violates energy conditions because it's quantum mechanics, whereby I have some bound solution that can actually tunnel through this effective potential to an unbound one.
Since you haven't told us what V is, does it always have that shape?
It always has that shape, and in these very nice dimensionless coordinates.
For all choices of parameters, can you choose a patching the way you're doing it in the sitter diagram where you're taking different slices and matching them to each other?
So you're actually talking about boosting or so?
What you actually showed us was a picture of a sitter where you identified curves and then you said
that's
right. And is it always going to be possible for all the trajectories with this potential to do that?
Yes.
Some choice of curves?
I mean, by construction, especially.
Okay.
Because I've assumed the background space-times, and if I can write this potential at all, then this is telling me that I can put those curves on the diagrams.
Okay.
So this process is rather strange in its original construction. I have some bound solution that I imagine, say, making, because this is classically buildable. It evolves to its turning point, so on the effective potential diagram I'm here now. And then there's some finite amplitude for it to tunnel through. And in real space, what this corresponds to, according to some guy in region 1 here, is the bubble wall quickly recedes. It forms a black hole, according to his perspective. But on the other side of a wormhole, there's actually this very large bubble that contains some inflationary universe. And this was how Guth and Farhi originally asked the question, is it possible to create a universe in the lab, with the affirmative answer. But for this talk, I'd like to make an observation. These original calculations were done in asymptotically flat space. But if I add a cosmological constant outside, Schwarzschild sitter is non-compact. So there's actually a number of different solutions. So here I've drawn the one on the other page. But if I just shift everything over one period, then I can draw this conformal diagram. Okay. Now these are two identical diagrams at this point. All I've done is relabel the regions. But this tunneling mechanism makes them very different. And that's because I start with a very specific solution. I start with this bound solution in region 1, and now it actually has two choices. So it could either choose to tunnel through a wormhole, or it could choose to tunnel out the cosmological horizon. And these two events are going to look very different to this observer in region 1. In one case, he sees the formation of a black hole. In the other case, he sees basically this huge bubble form that heats him up, and now he's in the new phase. So let's look at the zero mass limit, and let me show you how these two solutions are actually very different and very weird. So if I take the zero mass limit, I'm basically removing that wormhole. I'm taking away the singular regions. So in the case of these L geometries, the geometries that go through the wormhole, what I get is a creation of an inhomogeneous universe with nothing. And some universe where absolutely nothing happens. So the zero mass limit of these L geometries corresponds to the creation of an inhomogeneous universe with nothing. Whereas if I look at these R geometries, then if I take away the wormholes, basically I end up with the causal space-time of one of these Lee-Weinberg bubbles. So you remember these are sort of the standard fare for tunneling in a scalar field potential. So to remind you, to recap here, this is a three-step process that I'm telling you about. So somehow I have to form this bound solution in its expanding phase. And I'll tell you about a model for this in a cabinet cosmology in a few slides. Next, this bound solution is going to evolve to its classical turning point. And here I'd just like to point out that there are actually growing perturbations on this bubble wall. So if you decompose perturbations into spherical harmonics, some of those spherical harmonics are actually going to grow during this process. So it's not clear that you actually end up with some spherically symmetric nice bubble at the turning point. This might be important. Now, the next thing that happens is the bound solution has some chance to tunnel through this effective potential into an unbound solution. So let's try and understand all these various steps. We'll start with the last. Okay? So we can calculate the amplitude for this transition through the effective potential by using Dirac quantization and WKB approximation, and we are going to assume that the mini superspace is spherically symmetric. So I only consider spherically symmetric metrics. And this reduces to some easy quantum mechanics problem. So basically I take the ratio of the wave functions at the two classical turning points, square it, and I'm going to get some amplitude, okay, which is going to go like space. Now, I'd just like to note that there's actually a prefactor on the front. But in order to calculate that prefactor, we need to step away from the spherically symmetric in superspace. So if I can consider perturbations in the wall, I might imagine being able to calculate the next correction in each bar, which corresponds to the prefactor. But it's unclear how to do this, even in the case of a Zermatt bubble.
So the fact that you mentioned before, the fact that there's instability at the turning point, would not that mean that this prefactor will blow up?
It might mean that. But I'm not sure that happens.
So you expect this, when you make the ratio, that this blowing up the prefactor cancels out? There's the instability on both sides of the...
The prefactor is actually the prefactor in front of the ratio. So it's not a prefactor unit in the wave functions that I'm taking the ratio of. So there would be some prefactor on the front here.
Yeah. But this is the you're talking about the WK being pushed back.
That's correct.
Which is the determinant. So essentially, if there's some growing mode, it means that this determinant is going to zero, right? At some point. So there's some growing mode in this process.
There is, but so there are some issues.
So there's a potentiality for this ratio. Why does it go to zero or to infinity?
There is potential for that to happen. Unfortunately, the calculation that I did about the sensibility was in the thin wall limit. And if I step away from the thin wall limit, then the wall thickness is actually going to damp some of those perturbations. And so it's really, it's a detailed question that hasn't been answered. Yes?
What's the time scale for the instability?
It's short enough that you might imagine this evolving to very problematically large proportions by the time you get to the turning point. So let's say, what's that?
Set by the Hubble scale or by the geometrical size of the bubble? Or
it's set by the time, basically. Let me find a good picture. So I imagine forming this bound solution somewhere and seeding it with some perturbations. Okay. And then it's got whatever time scale it takes to evolve to this turning point before this tunneling mechanism occurs. So the time scale I'm talking about is the time that it takes to go from here to here. Okay, so let me tell you how this calculation goes first by illustrating a very simple example in one-dimensional quantum mechanics. So let's say I have some particle in motion described by this action. I perform a trick, which is to introduce some auxiliary variable tau. Okay? So I'm basically going to promote the time t in my original Lagrangian to a dynamical variable. I'm going to consider that. And then I'm going to have some constraints to impose to get me back to where I started. So if I perform some change of variables here and define some new Lagrangian L twiddle, right, which now is an action by integrating over tau, then I'm going to get some new Hamiltonian, which has t as a dynamical variable. Here is just the definition of these constraints. And I'm going to get a constraint. Okay. So if I evaluate this Hamiltonian twiddle, basically what I find is that this is given by the p twiddle t plus h, but this p twiddle t, of course, is just minus h. So this tells us that we have a constraint on this Hamiltonian, this new Hamiltonian, must equal zero. And if I want to quantize this system, basically I just promote this p to an operator, right? By doing so, I recover Schrodinger's equation by composing my constraint on the wave function. So this is an alternate derivation of Schrodinger's equation. Now let's do the full gravity calculation in analogy. So I'm going to assume, again, this mini superspace of spherically symmetric metrics. So I can write this generally as the form above. And of course, there are too many degrees of freedom here, right? Because these thin wall constructions that I'm telling you about really have 1 degree of freedom, the radius of the bubble wall. But I'm not going to gauge fix, because this can be problematic in quantization procedure. So I'm going to keep everything generic, and then I'm going to have some constraints to impose in the end. So here's the action. This is the matter degrees of freedom, which is going to include the wall. Okay, so the action of the wall is up to be here. And then I have this portion here. And in order to quantize the system, I'm going to have four constraints. Okay? and Hamiltonian densities associated with the variable t and r, and then I have these momenta associated with the lapse and shift. And I'm going to impose these on the wave functional and thus hopefully obtain a quantum theory. Now, just to guide you, these are the Hamiltonian densities. Their form will not be important. Let me just skip them. And now I'd like to apply the WKB approximation in order to describe tunneling through this effective potential. So in one-dimensional quantum mechanics, going back to the analogy problem, I've got some Hamiltonian that I can, of course, write as some series of operators Q times operators P. And to quantize it, basically what I do is promote these operators, and I'm going to have to deal with some operator ordering computing over here. So I'm going to have basically replace P with Q, P with P hat, and Q with Q hat, but then there might be some terms that are order H bar that have to do with operator ordering. In WKB approximation, I make an ansatz, right, which is that the wave function is just given by space. And if I look at the Schrodinger equation, of course, I have time-dependent piece, which is just u to t. And to lowest order in H bar, meaning I drop these terms up here, basically I just replace q with d sigma dq. Okay? So WKB approximation is free of operator ordering, because that's an important thing to know. And I get a constraint, right, which is that h, evaluated here, has to equal e. In order to solve this, basically I just integrate. So I get the phase by integrating p over this classical trajectory under the well with some constraint. So in the gravity problem now, I have more variables. Okay, so this space, say, could be a function of L, R, and little r. And I have, again, two Hamiltonian constraints to consider. And in the WKP approximation, just like in the one-dimensional quantum mechanics problem, I simply replace the momenta that I would have to consider by this derivative of phase. Except for now I have to consider functional derivatives instead of just regular derivatives. And I get some functional integral that I have to evaluate between these classical turning points. So I'll skip that, I'll tell you the answer. Here we have a graph, okay? So this is describing the tunneling under the effect potential. Basically, I'm plotting the log of this here, and the sigma is the magic ring, okay? So this ends up being a damped exponential under the well, as you'd expect in the analogous quantum mechanics problem. And this plot is for false vacuum bubbles. To guide your eye, as I go up, I'm going towards more probable solutions, okay? And on the bottom axis here, I'm considering various masses. Now, all these quantities are normalized to the bubble wall tension, which in Planck units is some number like 10 to the minus 50, if I just use dimensional analysis and things are set by the weak scale, maybe 10 to the minus 5 if it's suitable. So the first thing that I'd like you to note is that as I evolve to zero mass, this red curve corresponds to the R geometries of various masses. I recover the tunneling exponent for a Lee-Weinberg bubble. Okay. So I showed you before that the space-time, if I take the zero mass limit, reduces to the causal space-time of a Lee-Weinberg bubble. The tunneling amplitude also is reproduced. Another interesting thing that happens during this calculation is because those constraint equations I showed you before are second order in momenta, there's a point at which I need to choose a sign. So I'm taking some square root and I need to pick a sign. And this is actually really interesting, right? Because there's been this long-standing debate about the sign of the wave functional that has been left entirely unresolved. And in this calculation, remember, the zero mass limit of this L geometry corresponded to the creation of a universe from nothing. So there is this quantum cosmological fixing of a sign that I have to do at some point. And the interesting thing is that I need to pick the opposite sign convention for the R geometry and the L geometry. So perhaps by fixing the sign of the wave function of the universe, I would actually be choosing some sector whereby I only get R geometries or I only get L geometries. So this is work in progress. I don't have more to say about that, but it's interesting.
Question?
Yeah.
Yeah, so two questions with related. I mean, this problem comes from the fact that the Liouville equation is real, whereas the wave function is complex. So any solution, the complex conjugate is also a solution. But also any solution, the superposition of, any two solutions, the superposition is also a solution. So how could you possibly have an argument that fixes it? That is, whatever you choose, the other is also going to be a solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation with the same norm.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer to that question.
Well, nobody does. I mean, it's a fundamental problem with quantum cosmology.
Right.
But there's an analog in just quantum mechanics. If you did WKB for a wave function in a well, and you asked, if I start with a position or momentum eigenstate, then the thing you would be, the path you're looking for is the classical path, which is given energy or given momentum, depending on what you chose your wave function to specify. So if you're given the wave function on the inside of the well, and you come out, then you should be able to predict the wave function on the outside of the well from the local inside of the well, right? So, Now it's actually after you do the squaring in the ratio. So you might think that by fixing the, well, okay, I don't have a good answer for that right now, but that would be interesting to talk about later. Okay, so another thing to note on this diagram is that there's some maximum maps. Okay, so these line stops, and that just corresponds to working my way up this effective potential to the top. And you might expect that when I'm at the top of the potential, I'm not really tunneling through anything, and so the probability should approach 1. So this exponent should go to 0. Now, if you look at the L geometry, that indeed does happen. But for the R geometry, which reproduces this nice amplitude for something that we know and love, Weinberg-Koppel, that doesn't happen. So let me try and explain to you why. First of all, this maximum mass is pretty small. So let's say that I have energy set by the Planck scale, then all I need is a bubble about the mass of an ant in order to create an inflationary universe. And if it's the weak scale, then I need something in order to mass the Earth. Okay, good. So let's look at what the spacetime, the tunneling spacetime, looks like for these various masses. So here I've shown you on the L curve. Let's say we're tunneling between these endpoints. In the spacetime, that corresponds to this bound solution going through the wormhole to that unbound one. And as I work my way up the potential, you can see that the endpoints on the effective potential diagram approach each other, and the endpoints in the space-time approach each other. So the distance that this wall is required to tunnel is going to 0. And at the top, I recover some static solution, right? Because in this effective potential, I'm just kind of sitting on top of this well in unstable equilibrium at a constant r. So I end up with a bubble that has some constant r. And if I imagine fluctuating this solution, this corresponds to a mechanism that was first discussed by Garriga et al. And this is a thermally activated solution. Thermally activated because the symmetry of this instanton would be O3. Now, if I look at the R geometry, so again, to remind you, this one has a bound solution that tunnels outside the cosmological horizon to the unbound solution on the other side. And I go up, you can see that in the space-time, those turning points are actually diverging. Okay, they're getting farther away from each other. And so when I get to the top, I'm no longer talking about this absence of tunneling. I'm actually talking about taking this original region that I had in the bound solution and destroying it, replacing it with a new phase. So this is some quantum cosmological process that I'm discussing here. If I look at the high mass limit of true vacuum bubbles, exactly the opposite happens. So here, the R geometry is continuous in the sense that the endpoints approach each other as I take the high mass limit. But the L geometry now corresponds to the creation from nothing of this huge region over here. So
We see that for false vacuum bubbles, the L geometry is continuous in the high mass limit, and in true vacuum bubbles, R geometry is continuous. And strangely, both the L and R geometries have these quantum cosmological aspects that we're going to be forced to consider. So now let's talk about the total nucleation probability. So remember, a three-step process, bound solution, evolves, tunnels through the turning point. So I need to come up with a model for how I might produce this C. Now, to estimate how much this would cost, let's say I have some background to sitter space that's empty. If I put a point mass in that sitter space, it's going to cause the cosmological horizon to crunch in a little bit. And correspondingly, since the entropy is associated with the radius of this cosmological horizon, I've got some change in entropy that I can talk about. So I'm going to estimate the cost of making this seed basically as the entropy deficit caused by sticking a point mass in an empty sitter space with the cosmological constant I'm considering. Now I add to that, I multiply by the probability to go through the well, which is this e to the 2i sigma, in order to get the total tunneling amplitude, or need to go from empty to sitter space to inflationary universe. So for false vacuum bubbles, I have a plot here. You'll note first that the zero mass limit is always most probable. So as I run down to zero mass, it's becoming harder for me to tunnel through this well because the turning points are getting farther away from each other. But it's getting easier for me to make the seed because I don't have to fluctuate anything. So it turns out that wins, and the zero mass limit is always the most probable. Now this goes back to the theorem that Coleman proved for the nucleation of true vacuum bubbles in flat space, which was that the O4 symmetric solution is always the most probable, has the lowest Euclidean action. So you can see here, we're considering a more general class of instantonics, and we're including gravity, and we find the same. So go to zero mass, that means O4 grains. Another thing to note is that for false vacuum bubbles, I reproduce the Lee-Weinberg tunneling exponent, and for true vacuum bubbles, I reproduce the Coleman-DeLuccia exponent. So as I go to zero mass for the R geometry, I'm getting the right answer. Another thing, perhaps the strangest, is that false vacuum bubbles, the most probable thing to do is to make a non-inhomogeneous universe from nothing. So to make a false vacuum region, it's easier to start from scratch. It's easier to fluctuate this universe from nothing than to fluctuate it in a background, which would be the R geometry. For Coleman-DeLuccia bubbles, for true vacuum bubbles, the Coleman-DeLuccia bubbles dominate. So this is the most probable thing I would expect to form a region of true vacuum, lower energy. To summarize, basically, I've now shown you how a number of these tunneling mechanisms can be described by this one picture, this effective potential diagram. So in the top, I have thermal activation, or this huge creation of the universe from nothing. I have this deletion of the universe from to nothing, or thermal back activation, depending. And then going down, on one hand, I have an L-tunneling geometry process corresponding to thermal production of a seed, and then quantum tunneling, or the R-tunneling geometry. And then as I go to zero mass, I have either the creation of a universe from nothing, or these Coleman-DeLuccia or Lee-Weinberg bubbles. Now, what are the rules? So I've shown you all these mechanisms, but I haven't really told you what actually happens. And this is an interesting, outstanding question. So some of the issues that we met along the way was this sign convention in the tunneling exponent. Another thing that we met along the way was this strange high mass limit. So we have to ask ourselves, are we okay with having this creation of a universe from nothing with quantum cosmological ideas involved? And then there's something else that I didn't tell you, which was the fact that these interpolating geometries, the instantons that I'm constructing, are actually pathological in a certain sense. So they have a degenerate metric. Now, it's not clear that you should include these in the path envelope for quantum gravity, and this was noted originally by Hartley Christie Gubin when he did this. And this is an outstanding issue. So in conclusion, it's kind of unclear which processes are allowed. But we probably need more than semi-classical methods to come up with the right answer.
Sorry about this. The generic metric.
Yes.
What is the locus that you write?
So you have certain portions of the Euclidean exterior spacetime that are covered twice when I evolve from the initial value surface to the final value surface. And so that's the source of this degeneracy. So it's double value for certain positions. Okay, so in order to go to the next part of my talk, which is going to be about internal inflation, I need to discuss two types of backflow. So far I've only been considering positive cosmological constant. And these would be called recycling vacua, because basically they can be transitioned into, and eventually they can be transitioned out of. So we saw all these various mechanisms that might be happening for recycling vacua. But there are also terminal vacua. Now these have either zero cosmological constant or negative cosmological constant. So if I transition into a vacua with negative cosmological constant, the interior of that bubble will experience a big crunch. And basically nothing can happen. There's no way to get out, it seems. Perhaps one might imagine getting out by using one of these L geometries, because I shield myself from the crunch perhaps by going into a wormhole. Or maybe there's some kind of stochastic dynamics. Let's say I fall into the potential, but I'm not negative yet. Maybe I can crawl back up. There's also a zero cosmological constant, and then you hit the bottom, and since you have no energy available to go back up, and you stay there, essentially. You can go back up into sitter because you can think of it as a thermal system, so you've got some energy available to do something. So, can we make predictions? Now, this is a very contested topic, and we'd like to know, well, how maybe could we use these dynamics that I've described to talk about what some observer would actually see? So it turns out that if you crunch the numbers, these events are terribly improbable. I mean, we're talking about probabilities like e to the minus 10 to the 100, okay? So there's no one you can imagine that's going to live long enough to see this, unless they're very lucky, okay? So to connect with observations, we either have to assume some kind of ideological observer, okay, so someone who can live for a really long time, or we have to consider something like the principle of mediocrity, which basically says that what are we most likely to observe given that we are a typical observer? So now it's time for everyone to protest and say, well, how can you make this assumption and how is this possible?
Well, let me make the protest in this form. If inflation is eternal, isn't it overwhelmingly probable that we would be in a terminal vacuum and therefore with slightly negative cosmological constant?
Depends on what measure you use, and I'll talk about that.
But naively, almost every measure is going to give the conclusion I just said.
That's actually not true at all.
That's not true?
Yeah. So I can talk about that.
Okay.
But let me get to that, the definition of these properties first. So there are a lot of problems with this. I mean, what do I mean by a typical observer? Are we typical? Or can I imagine some more typical form of life that can do intelligent things? Or maybe don't even need life, I don't know. And what if we're not typical? What if we happen to live on the tail of some gas human and we're just here because we're here? Now, it's also unclear maybe, you know, how large a role do anthropics play? Or are we here just because we're here? Does this question even make it past, you know, lived off? So I'm aware of these. And let me try and proceed and tell you what a prediction might look like, okay? Given that I assume the principle of mediocrity. I'm assuming this is an assumption. So a prediction might look like this, okay? I've got some probability that a randomly chosen object X is going to observe the parameters alpha, okay? So X might be a galaxy, X might be me, X might be life made of silicon. I'm not making an assumption about this tip. Alpha is some parameter like a mass of an electron or a cosmological constant or some parameter that I'm thinking about measuring and getting an answer for. And now this is going to be made up of the product of two terms generically. Okay, so here I'm going to have some prior. Okay, so this is going to tell me that a randomly chosen object P has parameters alpha. And now this is kind of telling me how likely is it to find different regions that have parameters alpha. So you might imagine this object P is like a unit volume, or maybe it's counting bubbles, or maybe it's counting regions that have various parameters in some other way. And then there's some conditionalization. Okay, so this tells me how many x are associated with each p that experience alpha. So these x are galaxy, or human, or what have you. They're going to tell you basically how many observers do I have in each of these p. So I'm going to focus on the prior distributions first. Okay? And now, in answer to Lee's question, it depends on what prior you assume, whether or not it's overwhelmingly more likely to be in a given vacuum setting. Okay? So there's various ways that I might imagine doing this counting. And I would say that these are not mutually exclusive. It kind of depends on what question you're interested in answering. So some proposals are unit volume, maybe co-moving volume or physical volume. Bubbles of a given type, I could just count bubbles. Or maybe it's a segment of a world line between transitions. Okay? So in each of these cases, this prior is going to be proportional to something like the ratio of volume in one parameter phase versus the total volume, maybe the number of bubbles containing given observables, or in the last case, maybe the frequency of entry into bubbles with a certain parameter alpha. Okay? So I'm going to propose today that we need a new p in our toolbox. Okay? So these p's are insufficient because a lot of cosmological observables depend on how you get to a state and not really the properties of the state itself. So for instance, spectral index, all these inflationary parameters, they don't really care about what the properties around the minimum the vacuum path is. They care about how I got there. So just to give some examples, let's say I have this very small landscape. And it looks like this. Now, the tunneling in this field space, so just to avoid confusion, forget about the effective potential diagram that I showed you before. This is a scalar field potential. And I imagine tunneling from one field value to another field value. So there's some endpoints to this. Okay? So let's say I go between these two endpoints. I start in this vacuum and I tunnel here. Then I might have slow roll on this flat part of the potential, repeating as I bounce around the minimum. And you can see that if I come from the left, I'm going to get perhaps lots of e-folds of inflation because I have this flat part of the potential that I can access. Whereas if I came from the other side, let's say I start in this vacuum, and up here are the endpoints, my instant tunnel, then I don't get any slow roll. Basically, I just fizzle and end up in the bottom and get very few e-folds. So depending on how I access this vacuum B, I could have different cosmological observables. And I'll show you some nice parameters of this in a second. So it might also be important for determining what transitions are actually allowed. So let's say I have this case where B is now one of these terminal vacua. And if I come from the right, here are those endpoints I showed you. I'm already in the negative region of the potential, and I'm basically doomed to crunch. There's no way I can get out. But let's say I came from the right, so I transitioned to the flat part, and now there's some finite probability, since I'm still at finite at positive energy, for me to actually diffuse back up this hill and end up back here. So this vacuum is only terminal if I come from the right. So now I'd like to propose a measure, a way of counting transitions. Okay, so I'm going to count basically how many transitions of a given type I have given some landscape. And I can do this by making a Markov chain of transitions. Okay, so let's say I have a A to B transition, followed by a B to C transition, followed by a C to D transition. I'm going to have some chain that's going to be experienced by a given world line. So this world line exists forever, it's going to experience a number of transitions. So the probability of a transition, if this chain is Markovian, is just going to depend on the previous one. So I can figure out the probability to be at the next step in a given transition alpha by summing over this matrix that I've shown you here, multiplied by the previous transition. So to go through an example, let's say I want to figure out the probability that the I plus 1 transition is a B to A, then I have to take the probability that it was a J to B, multiply that out by this matrix, which tells me, given a J to B transition, how likely do I go B to A? And by doing this, I can build up the expected number of transitions of a given type. And this is going to be my proposal for the product. So to do an example, here I have potential, my mini landscape, and I construct this matrix mu by looking at six, so there's six nearest neighbor transitions I can consider. This matrix is general enough to consider all transitions between the states that I can imagine, but let's do it simplified. There's four normalization conditions, because this matrix is only the relative probability. So I don't care about the absolute probability, just how likely is it that I go left compared to right. So I have four normalization conditions, because each of these columns has to sum to one, and that leaves me with two free parameters. So I have epsilon and delta. Now, let's say I start with an A to B, because remember, since this is a Markov chain, I need to seed it with the original step. So I start with A to B with probability 1, apply this Markov chain, and I have to normalize it. Then, if I get, then what I obtain is basically, here's the probability of making A to B transitions on this world line and B to A transitions. Here's the probability to make B to C and C to B. And the important part to take in the end is that these relative probabilities that I told you about, they're made up of these probabilities that I was discussing in the first part of my talk, which are incredibly, incredibly small. So if I just deconvolve this, it's going to be some e to the action, okay, where these actions are incredibly small, incredibly, incredibly small. And are incredibly large, but it's e to the minus action, so the probability is small, sorry. So these actions are incredibly large. So if there's even a 1% difference between these, and their number is like 10 to the 120, then I still get some ratio that's going to be incredibly huge or incredibly small. So this prior, because of its exponential dependence, is going to make very, very, very sharp predictions. So what are the issues that come with this? So the first thing is that we need to know the transition rates to incredible accuracy, right? Because I've got these exponentials of huge numbers, I better be sure, given some very complicated landscape, that I know the actual transition rates to hugely good probability, to hugely good accuracy. Otherwise, I might get very, very bad predictions, very different predictions. So I would say that this is pretty pessimistic that one might actually imagine pulling this off. And this is a property of most of those objects P that I showed you in the beginning. You need to know these to very good accuracy. And you need to know the properties of the vacuum at very good accuracy, right? Because it really matters whether or not this is, say, terminal or recycling. So you'd get a very good, very different prediction if the vacuum energy was 10 to the minus 120 or 0, even though those two are very similar. So if we can make correlations between cosmological observables and transitions, because of all this exponential dependence, and given that we might be able to overcome these problems, then we can make potentially sharp predictions. So for instance, an example would be correlating the endpoint of the instanton, which has to do with the transition rate, to the number of defaults. So what we want to look for is prior dominated predictions, because then we can evolve a lot of, we can avoid a lot of the problems that come with considering anthropics. So we want parameters alpha that are not dependent on the conditions for life, because that question is going to be incredibly hard to define. Now, some parameters you might imagine are like the spectral index or the number of e-folds, where if they're just greater than a certain, if we have more e-folds than a certain minimal number, then life doesn't care, right? I still get structure formation, I still get galaxies, and I can do my counting by picking an object X, such as galaxy. Now, this was applied, so an example of using these objects maybe is using some anthropic predictions of cosmological constant and some predictions for axions and dark matter by Tegmark et al. And in these analyses, you are basically assuming that the conditionalization factor dominates the prior. Okay, so I have some conditionalization on these objects X that's very sharply peaked, and I have a prior that's very flat. So here, anthropic considerations dominate predictions. But if these priors can really work to give us exponential favoring of given parameters, that perhaps I can have prior domination. So again, I have to multiply these n's and p's to get this total prediction. And I might be able to give predictions that are very, very, very far outside of the observable range of parameters, of the observed range of parameters. So now we're at a sticky point, right? Because does this mean that my assumption about the principle of mediocrity was wrong? Or does this mean that the string theory landscape is making an incorrect prediction? So this is a topic that needs to get debated for sure to make something out of this. But it's a step in the right direction, I think. So now I'll conclude. First part of the talk, I showed you there were a variety of transition mechanisms. And then I basically left you in a state of confusion and said that we don't understand which of these occur. But it's important to sort this out if we're really going to take this eternally inflating universe seriously. Because they look very different. In one case, I'm making universes up in wormholes. In other cases, I'm eating up huge horizon-sized regions and replacing it with a new phase. Very different picture. So there has been some work. So I've done some work with Tom Banks on using his ideas about de Sitter space and detailed balance to talk about this. There's been some work using ADS-CFT correspondence and holography, where they looked at these L geometries going behind the wormhole in ADS. And actually, there's a very interesting result that, that they find this process to be non-unitary. So this might actually come to bear on the realistic application of the L geometry in de Sitter space. And there's also some interesting things in here that have to do with the initial conditions for inflation and these scary things called Boltzmann frames that I won't talk about. So it's important to sort this out. And the other thing that I showed you was that these transition-based measures can be applied to make potentially sharp predictions about cosmological parameters. So I'll stop there.
So we have a couple of minutes for questions. Anyone have a question?
So what's an example of a sharp prediction you think you'd be able to make with this methodology?
So for instance, let's say that I make a prediction for the number of inflationary defaults that's like 20 or 10 or something. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then we know that that doesn't really take care of a lot of problems that, it doesn't really take care of a lot of problems. So
what chain of reasoning would lead you to predict that the number of defaultings was 20?
Okay, so let's say I start with some specific model for the string theory landscape. So I have some potential, and I apply my prior to this potential. Okay. And this basically tells me the population of all the given types of transitions. Mm-hmm. Associated with each transition would, say, be a number of defaults to get me to the next vacuum. All right. So then I would have some prediction from my prior that would say, okay, given that there are tons and tons and tons of transitions with 10 defaults and almost no transitions with more than 60, then the prediction from the prior, because, and that prediction will probably be exponentially weighted, so this will be a very, very strong prediction compared to the size of this conditionalization factor. So maybe I imagine there's still a lot of galaxies with 10 defaults or something, or enough, you know, basically to be dominated by this exponential. That given the model and the prior, I have a specific prediction for the number of defaults.
Okay, so supposing that you were able to carry out the chain of reasoning. Uh-huh. Okay. I think we know from observation that if inflation was true, n is at least 60. So what would you conclude?
So now we have something to debate. So do we conclude either that the principle of mediocrity was wrong, my assumption was wrong in the beginning, that we're a typical world line, or, you know, our universe is on the chain of a typical world line. That's certainly a possibility. Or it could mean that the model is wrong, that this landscape that I've applied my measure to is not a realistic description of the world.
Okay, so let me try. So now let me try the argument that I was trying to make before.
Okay.
What you basically have, and this is very much like what people have been studying population biology for a long time. You have a bunch of discrete states, and you have transition rates between them, and you have a situation in which some transitions are overwhelmingly more probable than others. So you ignore the ones that are improbable, So you basically have a discrete dynamical system with a population randomly jumping on it. And then you have the topology of this thing, you have fixed points. The generic topology of these things are the fixed points, which are what you call terminal vacua.
Okay.
Okay. And there also have to be limit cycles where things go round and round. Okay. And that's if you follow any point, it either goes sooner or later to a fixed point or to a limit cycle.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So given that, and if you believe that this has been going on forever, okay, isn't it overwhelmingly likely, unless you fine-tune the initial distribution or ensemble, that we are at a fixed point?
No, so let me explain what can happen. So it turns out that in this measure, the most overwhelmingly weighted states are ones that can experience fast transitions back and forth. Because remember, here we're weighting according to the number of transitions.
So that's a limit cycle of two elements.
Yes.
Okay. So you say it's overwhelmingly probable to be in one of those.
That's correct.
Sure. Okay. So if there are limit cycles, you also can be in a limit cycle. But we don't seem to be in either.
Right. So now we can do some interesting things, I think. Okay. So can we make the fact that I can predict from this prior, given the number of transitions, where you're most likely to sit, and correlate that with something that we can actually observe, like the number of new moles in place?
No, or can we, another conclusion might be that since there's neither evidence that we're at a fixed point nor at a limit cycle, then this process must not have been going on forever.
Okay, so there's that as well. And that certainly is invalidating the assumption that I made in the beginning.
Then you can't argue for the principle of mediocrity,
right,
which is sort of... Yeah.
Exactly. No. That's the limitation for sure.
All right. So we're out of time. So thanks.